interns, earning nothing and learning little in the brave new economy.
I estimate in the book that there are tens of thousands of illegal internships each year in the U.S. I mean, you have people who are unpaid interns for 6 months in an office working full-time.
That's Ross Perlin. We talked to him about his explosive expose of the new intern economy, Intern Nation.
She transformed all of these dogs over the course of a year in a way that became remarkable to me. And I remember thinking, wow, if this is Lenore's work, and it's serious work, and if a dog can take all these diverse dogs and turn them into a family, maybe there's hope for people.
And that's John Katz, talking about his dog Lenore. His charming new book for children is Meet the Dogs of Bedlam Farm. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This month, thousands of college students will fan out throughout the nation to begin their summer internships. They're expecting to learn something about the careers they want to pursue and make connections that will help them land a permanent job in the future. That's the way it's supposed to be. But for the most part, that's not happening, according to my guest, Ross Perlin. His book, Intern Nation, says unpaid internships that fail to teach any skills are becoming the norm, displacing paid workers and subjecting interns to flagrant exploitation, including sexual harassment and dangerous working conditions. Universities are complicit, raking in fees for academic credit. It's illegal, and it's changing the way we view the right of workers to a fair day's pay for a day's work. Ross Perlin, first of all, I want to welcome you to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me, Francesca.
I can remember my son, who is now 31, just about a year or two ago, I believe he was at that time unemployed, complaining bitterly that the only kind of job that he could get that was paid was, and I'm going to have to bleep this out, a shit job. And that if he wanted to get a job doing something that was really interesting, he went to Pratt. He's an artist and a photographer. He would have to be an intern. And, you know, he's a father, a husband. He's trying to earn money for a family. He can't afford that. What is the scope of this problem? Was he right that that's the only kind of job that he could really get?
It's a troublingly common scenario. And there probably is a lot of truth to what he said. But at the same time, I think there's been a kind of devaluing of the regular paid jobs. There's a sense that these things are kind of dead-end jobs, that only an internship will constitute relevant work experience to move ahead in the fields where it's become this absolute barrier, this thing that you have to do to break in. So it depends on the scenario. He may well have been right, but I think there's still a lot of value in these regular paid jobs. I think, you know, one message that's being sent, say, to college students, is that being a camp counselor, babysitting, mowing the lawn, these kind of classic, you know, youth labor market jobs that have always been there, and that so many American kids start doing from age 14, 15, 16. The message now is that those things don't count somehow, that there's no value in that. Well, in one very obvious way, they certainly do count, that you make money off them. These are paid experiences. And even just, I think, earning money, especially when you're younger, that kind of financial education is important in and of itself, learning how to kind of manage money and the feeling of making money, of working and getting something out of it, something tangible like that. But even that aside, the life lessons from having regular jobs as well, I think the pendulum has swung too far. There's definitely value, of course, to seeing the specific field that you want to enter and having work experience just in that particular specialty or that particular field. But general training and general job skills are still vital and I think are being overlooked.
Yes, I agree with you on that. But I think the point is also interesting that you make in your book, Intern Nation, that to get the kind of job, especially in fields of the arts, entertainment, journalism, that it's the unpaid internship that does it. I mean, my son trained as an artist, and what is he doing? His paid job now is as a laborer carting valuable art around the city for one of the biggest art carters in the country. And, you know, he can get benefits and a good wage, but he's not working as an artist.
It's true, yeah, and especially when you get to a certain point, if he's already in his 30s and wants to be making progress in his career, there's going to be an intense feeling of frustration, and he probably doesn't see any direct line from the work he's doing to where he wants to be. So it's absolutely the reality for a lot of people, and I think that that makes it all the more galling that the internship has been kind of interposed between people's career ambitions and where they want to get to, and that it's something that they have to cross, they have to pay to play, and that otherwise, you know, they're unlikely to get there.
Well, tell us about the scope of this problem. How great an issue is this? How many interns are there? What percent of jobs are being taken by interns?
My best estimate in the book is that there are 1 to 2 million internships each year, but that's really only even just focusing on college students. That is extrapolating from the best estimate out there, that 75% of students at four-year colleges perform at least one internship before they graduate. So just extrapolating from that, you get to something like 1 to 2 million internships each year just in the U.S. In terms of the scope of the problem, I mean, you see internships now across the white-collar world in just about every industry, every sector, firms of all shapes and sizes, for-profit, non-profit, government, and now beyond, globally. You're seeing internships spreading across the developed world and even into the major cities of the developing world. So, of course, there are areas like in the blue-collar, you know, the blue-collar world, you don't see intern, you know, garbage men or janitors yet at this point. And then there are a lot of interesting reasons for that. But within the white-collar world, this has become pervasive.
Now, when I started out my radio career, I did an internship in my mid-50s with a, not for this radio show, I was already doing that, but as a freelance reporter. I did an internship with a local NPR station. It was great. I got to produce a series on homelessness. I worked, under the tutelage of the news director. I got a lot of great feedback. I basically learned on the job and didn't have to pay to go to J school. For me, it was perfect. But you say in this book, Ross Perlin, in Intern Nation, that that's not really the experience of most interns.
Well, first off, the use of internships as a kind of career-changing move, I think, is a relatively more recent phenomenon, probably just in the last decade or two. Definitely the core, the archetypal intern is still a college student doing this for a summer or possibly during the academic year. So in the book, I don't get too deep into career change internships, because I think that's kind of a fascinating subject in its own right. And I think, you know, to some extent may raise fewer issues, in that, you know, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they have a sense already of the labor market. They've been in the labor market. They've worked. And maybe they're more likely to have their own savings. They're more likely to have built up a kind of a support network that could get them through an unpaid experience for a delimited period of time. So I see them, I see people in that position as perhaps better able to negotiate the situation than young people.
And yet, that's the kind of interns that were around when I was in college. That's the kind of internship. But you say that the situation has really changed.
Well, in terms of the quality of the experience, I don't deny at all that there are lots of great internships out there, like what you described, things that really represent a kind of shortcut, a kind of way, not in terms of cutting corners, but just a way to really get to where you want to go, and where there's great mentoring, great training, and all sorts of things that then ameliorate the fact that you're not getting paid if. Assuming that this was an unpaid experience in this situation. For paid internships, it's kind of a whole other story. I think there's a lot more merits and you know, in many cases. So yeah, that's one point. The other kind of perhaps more important point that I try to bring out in the book that's less familiar here is it's not that internships are bad, or even that most internships are necessarily are bad. I actually want to cast some light on the question of people who can't do internships, the non-interns, the people who can't afford to work without pay. So the situation there is, you know, kind of a larger social question about access to certain professions, about social mobility, about what it means when you know, basically to go into, say, radio or television or publishing or film or fashion, you need to be ready at some point to work for perhaps several months at the cost of probably several thousand dollars in living expenses during that time, often in expensive cities. Also foregoing the opportunity to earn money, there are those opportunity costs. You need to be ready to do that, and not everybody can afford to do that. And so that has an impact on the makeup of those professions, and it has an impact on who gets ahead in a society that's increasingly dominated by kind of white collar work.
We're talking with Ross Perlin. His book is Intern Nation. It's the first look at this phenomenon of internships, mostly unpaid internships, how that is changing the world of work in the U.S. and, in fact, in the globe. When you say, you talk about the division between those who can do unpaid internships and those who can't as being really something that contributes to social inequality. Why is that? Why is the path to good jobs closed for those who cannot do internships? What is the internship phenomenon?
What is the internship phenomenon? That is the broad question that I try to explain in the book. Where did this come from? Why does the world now work this way? And, you know, to some extent, I think it's a new chapter in the kind of age-old battle between employers looking to save on their labor costs and between, especially young people trying to figure out how to enter the workforce, or in general, you know, with workers figuring out what is their bargaining power, what can they ask for. To some extent, it's a story about, you know, employers, especially in these kind of glamour fields, some of which we've just mentioned, which see, you know, huge demand to enter those professions. From their perspective, you know, I think something like one in 16 young Americans wants to become an artist. You know, this is, there isn't room for all of them to actually to do that, at least the way the economy is kind of currently constituted. So the employers realize that they kind of have this advantage, and that they can dictate the terms of entry. And one way in which they do that is by saying, "Well, you've got to work for me unpaid for a while. You've got to, you know, basically give me a free test drive so that I can see for a period of time. Are you somebody that I'm going to want?" Even that is perhaps a relatively enlightened attitude compared to some of what goes on, which is simply, employers saying, "I'm not even going to be hiring anybody, but you know, I will let you list me on your CV. You can mention that you had this job. I might give you a recommendation, but there probably won't be any jobs here. But you have to do an internship for me for a while, because I know you need that to get a job elsewhere, somewhere else." So I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think on the other side, on the side of kind of interns themselves, I think it's a matter of desperation to some extent. I think it's a matter of a changed generational mentality, in which the connection between work and wages has been kind of frayed, and people are used to more things being free. Perhaps, I mean, this is the generation free is supposed to be my generation. You know, that we we're used to internet business models, digital business models in which everything seems to be free, although, you know, usually there's no free lunch, I think, still, even today. So I think there's been a generational change in mindset as well, such that young people are understanding, perhaps, that this is a pragmatic approach, that they're going to probably have to do this, that they have to take a risk, that they're going to have to, they're already used to doing this at the level of college, going in deeper and deeper into debt with student loans, and seeing that as an investment, so that an internship is kind of another investment on top of that. And they're being encouraged, invest, with this idea, oh, you'll get paid off in the end, it'll work out in the end. And for some people it's true, and for some it's not.
We're talking about internships. Do they really serve the purpose they're supposed to, or are they just a way for employers to get free labor? We're talking with author Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. They're not even getting training in their field. You go to Disney and talk to interns who are there. Talk a little bit about this. This is a major corporation, and we have to say, these kids are getting paid.
Well, the Disney World internship program, which is as far as I could tell, one of the largest in the world, 7,000 to 8,000 college students each year working at Disney World, an appreciable percentage, proportion of the workforce down there. If you go down, the next time you go down to Disney World, I mean, take a look around, the people who are flipping burgers, the people who are picking up trash, the people who are working the monorails, even the people dressed up as Mickey and Donald may well be college interns. And they are getting at least minimum wage. I think Disney is careful enough not to really cross the line into illegal territory there. But what made the program interesting, and the reason that I decided to profile it, was that it's been given this whole kind of academic patina, this fig leaf of educational content, because it has, you know, a large advisory board of educators. They actively kind of truck in college credit and work with schools that gain college credit or the schools that issue college credit. They then charge students who are flipping burgers at Disney to flip those burgers. So it's one of these strange kind of places where you see what Andrew Ross, a professor at NYU, has called the quasi convergence of higher education and the knowledge corporation. And of course, Disney is more an entertainer, but they've understood that people, young people, will go down to Florida on their own dime, and in many cases make barely break even, because they're required to live in Disney housing, and they're on the meal plan, and they have all these expenses down there, and they're making very little. They will do that just to have the Disney name on there. On their CV, and because their colleges are letting Disney recruiters in, their colleges are touting this program and saying, this is one of the great experiences you can have. From Disney's point of view, it's simply a massive labor cost savings. They are able to basically use these interns as a kind of on a rotating basis for 4 or 5 months at a time, to preclude having to hire full-time unionized employees who still, but less and less, make up the bulk of employees down there.
So here we have a situation where universities are giving college credit for kids to work flipping burgers. It seems to me that there's kind of a pervasive corruption of not only the labor relationship, the labor-employer relationship, but also a corruption of the whole notion of what education is about and what college credit is. How does this work? Why are the universities doing this? What are they getting out of it? How did this come about?
I think that's right, that there has been a kind of devaluing of what academic credit is all about, and a kind of weakening of the whole idea of training and applied education. From the school's perspective, academic credit represents a revenue stream. When academic credit is attached to something, they charge for it. That is the currency of higher education in some sense. So if a student goes down to Disney and flips burgers, and then there's like a fig leaf sort of course that they might have called like marketing U, that they would attend a little bit when they're not flipping burgers on the side, the school, and of course not every school would do this. There are schools which would not grant credit for the Disney experience, but lots and lots that do. The student might want to get those credits because they can then graduate earlier, or they can say, well, I'm they can tell their parents, well, I was down there and I got credits as well. It kind of kept things going. For many internships, by the way, this isn't true of Disney. For many internships, the students are required by the employer to get credit in order to indemnify the employer, as the employer sees it, against a potential lawsuit. So that's another kind of situation where this is even a more serious problem.
And the universities are requiring that students do internships.
That's right. The requirements are coming at students from both sides. For many majors, for many academic programs, the university is requiring students to do the internship. For many internships, the company is saying, students, we're only going to let students do this who can get academic credit, who can go to their colleges and get that kind of approval. So, in terms of the schools and in terms of this as a revenue source, it's a very cheap way to provide academic credit.
Because they don't have to hire professors?
It's a form of outsourcing a student's education. You essentially have the student going off campus, spending all their time in an office somewhere or at a workplace somewhere. They're, usually is, or no classes going on in conjunction with that, no professors needing to be hired, no space, you know, no space on campus that needs to be allocated, all sorts of things like that. And yet schools are charging almost the exact same amount of money to students to go do that. So in terms of how do schools justify this and how do they perceive academic credit, what was fascinating about researching the Disney case was that these professors, or these, in some cases, career services personnel from universities who have the relationship with Disney, they spoke of Disney World as a vast learning laboratory, such that anything you do there constitutes learning. Flipping burgers, picking up trash, etc. That it's all learning, and because it's Disney, you know, this wonderful multinational famous corporation, therefore just by being with them, you will learn. To me, this represents a very kind of sad change in the notion of what experiential education should be all about. I mean, a wonderful ideal, you know, that harkens back to the late 19th, early 20th century, that education, you know, can happen out in the world. It's not just about sitting in a classroom. You know, there is applied learning. It's a wonderful ideal that, you know, to go out and learn by being in the field and by, you know, and by doing work. But I think that that's been corrupted to the point where people now can justify anything as being experiential education. And what's really kind of added fuel to the fire, I think, is the idea that in a more abstract white collar economy where you can't always sort of see the results, or you can't always kind of have a strict, clear, structured training program for everything, as you might with producing widgets, where you could say, okay, this is, you know, the training program constitutes literally just learning this skill. If you're, you know, entering the field of marketing or something like that, it's a little more abstract. So, but that's used as a kind of excuse, I think, to say, oh, well, training, you know, need not be structured. It can just be, you know, throw somebody in there and they will learn, and that constitutes education.
I guess I feel that that's not even really true, in the sense that they can, you know, that these are too vague. It seems to me almost any kind of job where real learning was going on could be structured around doing a project. For example, like the project that I did when I was an intern. It really seems that you're describing a kind of racket. A racket that also, as you've mentioned a couple of times here and now, I'd like to ask you more about it, is actually illegal. So talk about the legal issues that are involved with internships. What's a legal one? What's illegal? And why does it seem that the norm is toward the illegal kind?
I estimate in the book that there are tens of thousands of illegal internships each year in the U.S., just speaking under federal labor law, not even to mention possibly stricter laws that states would have. Essentially, the law surrounding internships, until very recently, and even now to some extent, it's not well known. It hasn't been very well clarified to people, or it's a little bit murky, but I think it's clear enough. There's basically a 6-point test to which every internship can be kind of subjected and scrutinized that goes back to a Supreme Court decision from the 1940s called Walling versus Portland Terminal. And that test basically laid out what it took to say that somebody should be exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the core piece of labor legislation that protects American workers, that guarantees a minimum wage, that guarantees overtime pay, and also, by the way, things, you know, like preventing child labor. So essentially, unless an employer can say that a certain internship meets all 6 of these criteria, they need to pay that intern just as they would any other worker. That intern is entitled to minimum wage, overtime, etc. Now, I think it's truly the rare employer that actually goes through when they're starting an internship program or hiring a new intern and says, you know, do we meet all 6 of these criteria? These are criteria from before the internship boom. They really were thought of in terms of trainees. The idea was, you know, that really these 6 criteria guarantee that unless you're basically running a training program, if you're running a short-term training program, it might be okay not to pay for a short period of time. But otherwise, if you are gaining immediate advantage, for instance, to use the wording of those of that 6-point test, immediate advantage being essentially, are you asking for real work from the interns? Are you having them perform real tasks that are making money for the company or furthering the business?
Or lowering the costs.
That's right. Or, you know, are you, you know, helping lower the cost of business for the company? Are you displacing workers? I mean, are these vital tasks? And the vast majority of intern situations that I've found, that is really what's happening. And the employer that's really running a training program, you know, training and recruitment program, where they're bringing young people in and, you know, not making demands from day one, is a rare thing. So I think employers are either, you know, not too aware of the law or simply ignoring it.
So basically the law says that an internship is not for the benefit of the employer. It has to be for the benefit of the intern. It cannot displace any actual workers. It has to be also, isn't that right? It has to be some real learning and training has to be going on. That is, it has to be for the benefit of the intern, as I said. And that's the key thing. So what now has been the response of employers since this has become a little bit better known? What's been the response? Do you think that there's any changes going on in this?
Well, I think, you know, to some extent, there are signs of some employers starting to worry about whether they're in compliance with the law. You know, I know of at least a few cases where employers changed their tune and realized this. But others, I think, have tried to find other strategies. I think the academic credit issue, again, has kind of muddied the waters because, according to some interpretations about this, if a school issues academic credit for an internship, that might sort of tilt the 6-point test in favor of the employer. They can say, well, look, this really was for the benefit of the intern. This really was an educational experience. Look, this university here issued credit. But again, universities are not really applying the 6-point test. Universities are issuing credit willy-nilly, I would say, you know, again, because they have skin in the game. They have an interest. So I think a lot of employers are still kind of waiting on the fence to see what will happen. Will there be any enforcement? In general, there has never been any proactive enforcement on this, even when it's widely known by just about everybody that certain industries and certain companies are offenders. You know, I think most people think that, you know, the Labor Department is far away and, you know, they generally don't do much in this regard, and that young people are too scared or too interested in having people, you know, having their boss as a reference to report anything. So,
and in fact, you point out as well that these interns are not at all under any protection of the labor standards, so that they are ripe for exploitation, for sexual harassment. Talk about some of the gender issues here.
I think one of the most galling things, and much less well known, is the fact that unpaid interns are also not entitled to any of the workplace protections that American workers typically enjoy. So basic civil rights, protection against sexual harassment on the job, you know, sort of fair hiring practices, et cetera, and so on. And the reason is a kind of deep legal one, that they are not counted as employees because they're not getting paid, because the sort of common law definition of an employee has grown up around pay. And so literally, I mean, you have people who are unpaid interns for 6 months in an office working full time. And from the law's point of view, they are just bystanders who happen to be holding down a cubicle, who happen to be sitting there, which is, of course, patently absurd to common sense and absurd from every perspective. So there have been some legal cases, particularly around sexual harassment, because of the creepy gender dynamics and sexual dynamics that often happen with internships, the power dynamics. And in these cases, essentially, courts have thrown out the claim of the intern and said, we're not even going to listen to the merits of this case or et cetera, because you're not an employee. You don't have any standing in this court. You know, one recent study that I cite in the book found that 77% of unpaid interns were women. What this reflects is the representation of women in the white-collar world and the representation of women in professions where unpaid internships are prevalent and widespread. These fields we've talked about, like film, fashion, publishing, the art world. And so I think this represents a gender issue, and it's never framed and never discussed in those terms. But one thing that I hope will come out of the book is people beginning to think about some of these broader ramifications and these broader issues.
Ross Perlin. He'll be back to talk more about internation in the second half of our show. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. He says the growth of internships in this country and abroad is a phenomenon that's displacing paid workers and signaling a major change in the labor force, especially in the highly coveted fields of fashion, journalism, and entertainment. You mentioned these glamour fields, entertainment and fashion, etc., but government and the nonprofits are the other major sectors where this is happening. Washington, you say, actually runs on interns. You have these 20-somethings who have little to no experience, in some cases actually doing the major business of government. Talk about that.
In some ways, Washington, D.C. is kind of the internship capital of the world. It's one of the places where you go, especially in the summer, if you're walking around Capitol Hill or walking around the Foggy Bottom area where thousands and thousands of interns live. You just feel this internship culture, which is so thick there and becomes such a part of Washington, D.C. Internship programs are literally everywhere in D.C., from the White House, which has unpaid interns, to Capitol Hill, where there are thousands of unpaid interns who are specially exempted from the laws we've just been talking about by one particular clause that Congress passed back in the 1990s. I mean, a particularly shocking thing, exempting their own interns from the law that, you know, people should be paid.
So what you're saying here is that in the cases where the kind of internships we're talking about would be illegal elsewhere and employers have to really conform with the law, Congress would still not have to conform to the law with its own interns.
That's right. As I understand the law, Congress essentially wanted to bypass the whole six-point test question, and Congress alone for their interns has just a single-line exemption that puts the whole issue to rest. So
what does this mean, that you have the business of the federal government being conducted by people who have no protections under the law? I mean, what does this say about the consciousness of our government when it can exempt itself from its own basic fundamental labor laws?
I think what it demonstrates is that within the government there's very little sense of the conditions of work, and that the political system runs in a number of ways on unpaid labor. I mean, just look at campaigns as well. You know, what sort of may have begun as the spirit of voluntarism really has grown into a monster, meaning that you cannot enter the world of politics, you cannot enter the political system without working unpaid. And, you know, there's so much sort of, you know, mania about controlling budgets and interns are just considered something that you shouldn't have to pay for. It's a way to kind of extend your capacity to bat above your weight if you're a congressman or if you're a government office or a lobbyist or a think tank or a nonprofit. It's a way to kind of, you know, do more with less. And I think that there's in the kind of arms race to have more and more capacity to do more and more things, to have more and more influence, organizations in Washington just have loaded up on interns and haven't looked back. I mean, this is not to say that all interns are doing vital work, especially on Capitol Hill. Internships represent a kind of patronage mill where it's senators pulling in the children of various donors and the nephews of various influential people in their district. And they're mostly churning out the letters to constituents or conducting Capitol tours or things like that. But in some places, though, on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in D.C., interns are performing extremely vital work. I mean, they're writing the speeches that elected officials are giving or shaping policy. And I think there's just no consciousness about this stuff. People in D.C. don't. It's just the air they breathe. It's completely naturalized, and they don't think twice about it.
In fact, you point out that during the last time that the government actually shut down, during the Clinton administration, you know, we recently had the case where our government almost shut down, and it might again over the debt, raising the debt ceiling. That's what the situation that allowed the Monica Lewinsky scandal to unfold.
Monica Lewinsky, of course, is seen as the kind of the classic intern. That's the person that pops into everybody's head. And actually, in fact, she was the classic intern in some ways. She came from a relatively privileged background, that, such that she had two internships in the White House, which were secured through family connections, even though the White House claims to run a meritocratic internship program. The reality is that, like almost everywhere in Washington, D.C., the process of getting an internship is extremely opaque and turns on connections. And this, by the way, is a larger problem with internships as opposed to jobs. I mean, however much of a role connections play in terms of landing jobs and getting gigs in different professions, with internships, the situation is significantly worse because it's there's such a casual, permissive attitude around internships. But in any case, as you say, Francesca, this particular thing in November 1995, this government shutdown, the interns were the only ones who didn't go home. They weren't getting paid anyway. All the paid, with the government shutdown, all the money was shut off, and so paid employees at the White House, paid staff, all went home to kind of wait it out. How could they carry on the functions of government then? They brought the interns in. And it's actually a situation that's happened in other areas as well, in other companies and other situations. Interns are kind of mobilized as a flex-time labor force, you know, to fill a breach, to step in and when there's a gap. So at that point, you literally had, you know, interns stepping into the roles of full-time staff. And from what I've gathered about it, that is part of what allowed the whole Lewinsky-Clinton scandal to unfold.
And now, what about the larger issue that these internships are basically open, as you say, just through an opaque process, through connections to those who are already privileged and elite? We're talking about government, we're talking about journalism. What does it do to those fields and to the larger discourse in America that it is only the people who are wealthy enough to work unpaid who are getting these influential jobs?
Well, I think it represents a serious threat to meritocratic principles, to ideas of fairness that we have about how our society works. And it's particularly these professions, ones we've mentioned, politics, film, publishing, the arts, entertainment, that are rife with unpaid interns, that represent some of the most influential professions in our society. So whether or not, you know, the financial gains in those are greatest, these are the opinion makers. These are the opinion makers of the future. These are people who are shaping our society and shaping policy. And people I've talked to in those professions, they tell me that one of the single biggest problems in the profession is the diversity of voices, or lack thereof. And of course, this has been an issue on people's minds in terms of gender and racial diversity for several decades, and there are various attempts to address it. And this represents that same kind of issue, but on a class basis in terms of class diversity. So I think, to take an example that a journalism intern gave me, if you don't have people from lower income backgrounds entering journalism, you're going to have a different kind of coverage of the issues that the working poor face, just to give one example. These things are difficult to quantify. They don't lend themselves easily to statistics, but I think the effects are subtle, powerful, to some extent already beginning to be felt, but probably will play themselves out most as this kind of internship generation of the last few decades really rises to the top of their fields in the next 20, 30 years.
So maybe it's no surprise that there's such anti-union fervor among so many in government, certainly on the right, and so little defense of the power of unions on the so-called progressive side.
I do think that part of why unions are kind of not in most people's frame of reference who are in the kind of white-collar world, why, you know, in the sort of political and media elites, there's no understanding of these issues in some sense, because they themselves, you know, have never been in a union. They don't have family members who are in a union. The blue-collar world is kind of, you know, the other. It's a realm unto itself that people don't understand. Without that personal background, without that experience, without the diversity of voices in the opinion-making fields, you have a skewed perspective.
So what is to be done?
I offer a range of prescriptions in the last chapter of the book. On the part of employers, I think it's very clear that they need to start paying for real work. In the few cases where they want to offer really a training program and don't want to pay, they need to really ratchet up the quality of the training. They need to think hard about the 6-point test and about what they're doing in terms of their industries. on the level of individual employers, I mean, we've seen a place like the Atlantic Media Company, for instance, a year ago, in light of some of the publicity about the law, saying, we're going to change our program. We're going to start paying our interns. We're going to make this a good experience, a conscious experience. We're going to be, you know, clear about hiring, et cetera. On the level of a profession, one very interesting example I talk about in the book is the architecture profession, which used to be notorious for eating its young, as they say. And in the 1990s, things kind of reached a fevered pitch, and a particularly strong, essentially student organization within the architecture field really pushed for change and basically came up with an industry-wide, a profession-wide solution, a new code of ethics such that if you took unpaid interns, if you promoted illegal situations in your firm, you would be persona non grata. And that prompted a culture change. In terms of educational institutions, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that laid out some very concrete steps, including not charging students to work, not posting illegal opportunities, not allowing employers who are offering illegal internships to hawk their wares on campus. Right now, 95% of colleges simply allow unpaid internships with very little scrutiny to be advertised on campus. And then I would say, in terms of government, I want to see enforcement of the existing law. I think it's something of a mockery right now. We've described here the 6-point test, and a lot of people now know about this, but with almost no enforcement, people won't take it seriously. Lastly, in terms of interns themselves, I think it takes a kind of change in mindset. People need to value their own labor. They need to understand that, as you say, it's become something of a racket. Of course, for any individual person, there are going to be particular considerations, what they can afford to do and what they can't afford to do. But I think young people need to act collectively and to think more collectively, to talk to fellow interns, and to, if they do wade into the unpaid internship game, to do so very carefully and warily and get out as soon as they can.
Well, Ross Perlin, you're... fascinating book is Intern Nation. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Ross Perlin is a researcher for the Himalayan Languages Project in southwest China. He's written on disappearing languages in the U.S., China, and the former Soviet Union. Intern Nation is his first book. It's out from Verso Press. You can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Author John Katz has charmed adult readers for years with his tales of the dogs of Bedlam Farm, the rural homestead he lives on near Albany, New York. Now he's come out with a terrific book for children called Meet the Dogs of Bedlam Farm. In it, he tells the stories of Rose, Izzy, Frida, and Lenore, working dogs all, and how they work together to create a community of love and cooperation. John Katz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
We first talked to you, it's a long while ago now, close to the beginning of the show. We started in 2004. You've written a series of books about Bedlam Farm, all for grown-ups, and now a children's book, which I want to congratulate you on making it onto the New York Times bestseller list.
Thank you. 1 week. That's a first. That's a record.
That's incredible. So here we have Meet the Dogs of Bedlam Farm. First, introduce us to Bedlam Farm. Tell us about it.
Bedlam Farm is a 90-acre farm in upstate New York, about an hour and a half northeast of Albany. Halfway up, not all the way up. It's a Civil War farm with four big old barns and three or four pastures, in which I have. I live and I write here, and I'm a photographer, and as well as a writer. And I have some animals. I have four dogs who are focused in the book, Izzy, Lenore, Frida, and Rose. And at the moment, I have two donkeys and a bunch of sheep. And it's enough, I think.
Now, how did you come to go to Bedlam Farm? You used to live in New York City. It's quite a shift.
I've actually never been, I don't think I ever was on a farm in my life until I came here. And I think there are a lot of reasons. I wanted to write more about animals in a more kind of thoughtful and expansive way than I think a lot of animal literature does. Because I wanted to just experience living with them. I also love rural life. I love being back in nature. And I think for personal reasons, I was looking for some things in my life. I think issues to do with fulfillment and self-determination and living a kind of considered life. And I felt I needed to go away somewhere to do that. So it was a long process complicated and sometimes great and sometimes not. But I think it's turned out to be a great thing. And now, of course, it's led to this.
Yeah, and so much of this rural journey of yours has been, in fact, has been intertwined with the animals, especially the dogs that you've had.
I think there's a spiritual element and a healing element to animals. I think animals are so emotionalized and personified, the cute and adored pet, and anthropomorphized. I think there's something, you know, I think it's important. I think most Americans, as I was, are disconnected from the natural world. And very disconnected from the animal world, and I think it's hurting them. And I think they lead stressful, disconnected, fragmented lives. And I think the natural world is much more orderly, is much more comprehensible, it's more accepting, and it's very beautiful. And I think there's a spiritual element to it's really brought to my life. That's what I really try to write about as much or more than the dogs.
Huh. And yet the dogs really provide so much of the emotional grounding of your books. And now let's meet the dogs of Bedlam Farm. Let's start with Rose.
Rose is a 7-year, 8-year-old border collie, a very serious working dog. I've written 3 books about her. And I greatly admire Rose for her unfailing work ethic, for her courage, for her focused determination. She's really my partner on the farm. I think I would not have survived here without Rose. She's a problem solver. She is smart as anything. We've just figured it out together again and again and again. And she's not a dog who wants to be in your lap, and she doesn't want to cuddle, and she doesn't want to be your friend. She wants to work. And it's different. She's not quite a pet. Well, she's certainly very loyal, and she's good to be around, but she's not a dog who wants to sit in your lap and get scratched.
So you say you would not have survived without her?
Well, it was tough up here. You know, the winters are tough. I had a lot of accidents and incidents, fell down, knocked myself out a few times, and Rose would get me up. We were assaulted by wild pigs that came through the woods one night. We ran into a bear, coyotes, and many storms and blizzards and lambing and things I really, frankly, was not very prepared for. And Rose was always there, always helped me out and was there with me and gave me a lot of strength and helped me figure things out. You know, we ran across a deer trapped in the pasture gate, and Rose distracted her until I could unlatch it. And when the lambs were born in the winter, she found them and kept them with her mothers. And an amazing, amazing dog.
And how did she come into your life? And did you actually train her, or did she know this by instinct?
I think Rose trained me, really. But I got her from a breeder in Colorado, and she came from a working line. And I knew I would need a working dog. I was going to have sheep. But I had no idea how amazing the relationship would be and what she was really capable of. I guess I sort of trained her, but not really. She's a farm dog. Farm dogs grow up around. She's been around these animals almost every day of her life, so she's very comfortable here. And she has evolved. She just deals with what. I mean, I did some training, but I can't take credit for that. I see other farm dogs too who are wonderful in that way. They just figure it out. They grow up with the animals. They live with the animals. They know them. And the farmers give them tremendous responsibility and freedom, which they rise to often. These dogs get to live the life of dogs, and I think too often dogs in America don't. They really are so circumscribed. They can only be on leashes. They can only walk in a neighborhood. So Rose has risen to the opportunity she's had to fully live the life of a working dog, and she has certainly risen to it.
And then there's Izzy, who really came to you in quite a different way, a very different kind of dog. How did you get Izzy?
Izzy's a border collie also. He was abandoned on a farm not too far from me. The family moved away, and he somehow was left behind there. And he lived outside there for 4 or 5 years. A couple of other farmers and a caretaker would drop food off every now and then for him. But he lived outside, and even in the winter. And finally, a rescue group decided it was time to round him up. And it took us quite a deal to catch him. And he was a little crazy, but I got him. And he settled down, and he went with me for training to be a hospice volunteer and just took to it. It's this amazing, natural, empathetic, you know, also a working dog, and just used his instincts to communicate and connect with people at the edge of life. Another very powerful experience, very different. And again, it's something that's not easy to train a dog for. He really took to it.
Do you think he took to it partly because he himself was abandoned?
You know, I don't know. You know, I hesitate. You know, you don't know what's going on in a dog mind. I think it was really work for him. You know, I think border collies, dogs look for work, and I think he found this work. He attached to people, and he connected with them, and I think he liked the attention and the focus. and the sense of approval he was getting and reinforcement, so it just became his work. I think it's important, you know, one of my themes is understanding the nature of these animals. You know, we're always putting our emotions and thoughts into their heads, and I think it's very, very important. And in my writing, even with the kids' book, I try to reinforce this, that these are animals. There really are no good dogs, and there really are no bad dogs. They don't make moral judgments. You know, their complexity comes from their animal nature. And I think with working dogs, most dogs really, if you find some work to do, they will love to do it, and they will often rise to it.
And this is one of the themes of your book, that each one of these dogs has a job. Rose and Izzy, that's pretty clear. Frida as well. Tell us about Frida and how did you get her?
Frida's another great story. She came with my wife. I've been remarried about a year. And my wife, Maria, went to a shelter one day, and they had this dog they were about to put down. It had been in the shelter for months, 9 or 10 months. And a Rottweiler Shepherd mix, a very intimidating-looking dog nobody wanted to adopt. My wife thought she was adorable, and she took her home. And then I met her. We weren't married at the time, and Frida was a tough dog. She'd been abandoned in the Adirondacks, lived out there for the wild for 3 or 4 years, and it took the ASPCA more than a year to catch her. She was just impossible for them to track down and snare. Eventually they did, and then she languished in a crate for the better part of a year. So she and Maria are very powerfully attached, and she has also found her work, which is really guarding the farm. She really protects the farm. She watches out for it. She raises a lot of noise when somebody comes in, and she looks very, very scary, but she really isn't. She's never hurt anybody, and I think she's really a pussycat, but she makes quite a bit of noise. And when you see her running at you, you definitely pay attention. She looks like a lot of dog. And then the fourth dog was Lenore, who was one of the centerpieces of the story, a Labrador, a black lab, who was really, called her the Hound of Love, because she's just all about love. And I noticed taking pictures, I kept seeing these pictures of Lenore transforming the other dogs. You know, Rose, a very serious dog, had never played ever. And Lenore would just torment her until she started playing tug of war. And then she began to play, and Frida wouldn't let none of the other dogs anywhere near her. And Lenore would run up and just lick her on the nose and keep doing it until Frida just basically gave in. The two became pals. And Lenore did this with the donkeys. She did this with the barn cats. And these are animals that don't like dogs and don't like to be around dogs. But Lenore just simply would not be deterred. You know, she's the barn cat mother, who is a terrifying creature. And Lenore would run up to her, the tail going a mile a minute, and mother would hiss and swat at her, and Lenore would just give her another lick. And then they just became pals, so they hang out together. So what I saw in the photographs, I realized I was also seeing it in the real world as well. Lenore had seemed to take her work, had become lightening up these dogs and seemingly showing them how to live together. Whenever I looked, she was charming one or the other, or she would gnaw on Izzy's head and get him to sleep next to him because he never lived inside. And whenever Frida got rambunctious and loud, Lenore would just wag her tail and run up to her and cuddle with her. And she got Rose playing. So she transformed all of these dogs over the course of a year in a way that became remarkable to me and quite apparent in the photographs. And I remember thinking, wow, this is Lenore's work, and it's serious work. And if a dog can take all these diverse dogs and turn them into a family, maybe there's hope for people. Maybe Lenore ought to go to Congress.
Well, I have to say, I field tested this book, Meet the Dogs of Bedlam Farm, and we're talking with the author, John Katz. I field tested it with my 7-year-old granddaughter, who totally loved the book. But she decided that she wants to have Lenore. So that was the dog that really, she wormed her way into my granddaughter's heart.
That's
as
great.
Well. And she had a question for you.
Okay.
She actually had two. One, she wanted to know how old Lenore is.
Lenore is 5.
Okay. And she also wanted to know, why is Lenore the way she is?
That's a great question. I think we never know totally what goes into a dog's heart and mind, but I think Lenore came from a wonderful Labrador breeder, and she has been breeding Labradors for maybe 10 or 15 years, and she's been working very hard to develop a breed of Labrador that's very sweet, very loving, and very good with people. So I think that might be a case of really a good, grounded dog who is very, very well-bred. You know, everybody loves rescue dogs, and I have a couple, and they're great, but some good breeders can also do wonderful things with dogs like Lenore and breed these qualities of temperament into them that are hard to get otherwise. So I have to credit her with Lenore's nature.
That's wonderful. Now, writing a children's book, this is your first one, is that right?
Yes, it is. My first one.
And how did you get the idea to do a children's book? And did it present any different challenges to you between that and writing books for grown-ups?
I found it shockingly difficult, much more so than I would have ever imagined. I thought it would be easy because they were small, and that's a mistake. I think what gave me the idea, well, the children I meet are the purest animal lovers that I know, and animals are so important to childhood development in terms of trust and affection and responsibility. And I thought I had these four dogs, and something to me very touching had happened, that the four dogs, very, very different from each other, and some of them kind of trouble dogs, could come together in this very loving and comfortable family. These dogs never fight. They're together all the time. They go for walks together. They play together. And I thought that would be a message that would be very powerful for kids, both in terms of dealing with things that are different from them, of feeling isolated because you're different, and also of being interested in family and the family dynamics. As I've done these readings around the country, I'm shocked to see how fascinated kids are by the dynamics between Lenore and Rose, Lenore and Frida. You know, what were they like, and how did they react, and were they angry? And you could see them working out issues in their own lives of where they fit in and what their families were like. And also the idea that love was work, love is very important, love is very powerful, I think became a very relevant idea even in the course of doing the book, more so than I even thought it would be.
That's wonderful, and I think I definitely felt that in reading this book. It's very moving, actually. And then you said it was very difficult.
It was very difficult. You know, I mean, people read the book and tell me that they cried. And at first that really shocked me because it's not a sad book at all. But there is something very touching about what this dog did. The hard thing for me, I've written 21 books for adults, and everything about it is completely different, everything. The way you structure a story, the way you look for a plot, the way you move a story along. You know, there's a structure to this book about what is Lenore's work, what is Lenore's work. It's repetitious, and I thought, oh, my God, it's just too repetitious. It's too simple. Nobody will like that. But I understood later that the very simplicity of it is what they liked about it, that it gave kids your granddaughter's age an opportunity to follow this simple idea. What is Lenore's job? And they're very pleased to find that Lenore's job is love. And so I have to say my editor was more responsible for that particular thing than I was. I think the other part that really contributed to the book, and a big surprise, were the photographs. I've become a photographer in recent years. I love taking pictures, and it's been a huge part of my life and my blog and my work. And I think this idea of, you know, these aren't traditional illustrations. The pictures are very different. Animal photography is very difficult, and I've worked very hard at terms of getting lenses and figuring out the light and getting their faces. And that, I think, gave so much credibility to the story for kids because they weren't seeing an illustration of Lenore. They were seeing Lenore. And you could see in her face, there's a great picture of her in the book of her with a fly on her nose and staring lovingly at the fly. And you see her chewing on Izzy's head and getting Frida and kissing Frida on the nose. And those are very powerful pictures, and I think they transform the text into something that kids can immediately relate to. I also think kids love figuring out the politics of the dog. You know, this Frida's the bad dog, but she's not really bad. And so that it all turns out okay. And I think this is a happy ending, you know. Love triumphs. I see these kids grow up and they see adults squabbling all the time. They watch television, you know, and they are aware that the adult world, you know, disagreement often does not end well. So here's a case where if a dog can do it, maybe they can do it.
Well, it is just a wonderful book. Meet the Dogs of Bedlam Farm. John Katz, thank you so much for talking with us about this book and so much for writing it.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. It's great to talk to you.
In addition to his latest book for children, John Katz is the author of The Dogs of Bedlam Farm, Dog Days, Rose in a Storm, and many others. You can see a movie about The Dogs of Bedlam Farm starring Lenore by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.